This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Well, we've all watched weeks of agonizing testimony end this last Friday, a stunning 11-1 deadlock, leaving everyone without closure. It's a pure emotional whiplash for the families and the public who followed every minute of the trial. And we're going to break it down. What happens next? We're going to break down the actual human mechanics of the hung jury and what dragging everyone through a second trial actually means. With us to do that, Bob Mata, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, and of course, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Well, as predicted, we had a holdout. We just watched the jury grind for 7 days, only to hang on the one single holdout who said, yeah, no, I think she's guilty, no matter what. According to Reddington, someone who was not following the instructions of the judge to the jury. That, I think, is where a lot of us kind of get lost, Bob. I mean, take us into that jury room. They're given instructions. The instructions here, you have to determine if she is not guilty by reason of insanity. And it's the state's job to prove it. In this case, it's not the other way around. And the jurors basically telling the judge, we don't think this one juror is following your instructions in that specific realm. The jury instructions also talk about following your convictions and what you think is right. I mean, it ends up being confusing, to say the least, after an hour of instructions, to expect everyone to walk out of that space and go, oh, I get it. I'm going to be perfect on this, I think is a bit of a task with hour-long instructions. How do you think this went down in that jury room now that we've had a weekend to kind of soak this all in?
Well, I think that to try to kind of understand it, and obviously we're speculating, you know, but inside that room, I think that the first thing that we have to try to understand is that by day 7 of the deliberations, in my estimation, nobody is arguing about evidence anymore, right?
Yeah.
They're arguing about each other. The 11 that have already walked the holdout through every exhibit, all the experts, every instruction. And then when that fails, you know, the room stops being about a deliberation and becomes kind of like a siege, you know, where it's 11 versus 1. And, you know, the majority is cycling through, you know, persuasion, and they're frustrated and they're angry, they're exhausted. I mean, 40 hours of deliberation, or damn near 40 hours, is exhausting.
Yeah.
You know, you're coming in day after day. And you know, try to imagine being in it, and forget about sides in terms of which side is which side right now. Just imagine being 11 people on either side trying to convince one, and it's like smashing your head against a brick wall day after day after day after day. So you can imagine that would get very frustrating, right?
Yeah.
It would be exhausting. So ultimately, the foreperson in the case apparently sends the note telling the judge that the holdout, in the word that the judge used, the phrase is that the holdout acknowledged doubt, but was refusing to apply the law as to reasonable doubt. And at that point, you know,
what
is that appropriate?
That, right there. What refusing to apply the law to reach reasonable doubt? I think that's where a lot of confusion comes in and understanding, because we're talking about individuals who have convictions, which is another very loose term. I mean, applying the law to determine if there's reason. What if someone just says, fuck it, I don't care, she killed the kids?
Yeah, I mean,
that's their conviction. They're that is following the judge's instructions, but it's also not applying the law.
Right.
So at the same point, again, this is where it gets so muddy with the damn instructions and muddy with what are we expecting out of 12 human beings to really come up with here? We're wanting the human aspect of a person giving what their core beliefs are on something and applying it as a juror. But we're also saying you better follow this to a T, even if following it goes against your own conviction. I mean, we're asking them to basically become a computer to a certain extent while still maintaining their human abilities. Why don't we just have AI do it at this point? You might truly get what you're asking for then, because I don't think you're going to get it out of humans. I mean, let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah, no. And look, we've been talking about, you know, the different types of jurors that could be on this case, right?
Yeah.
You know, we have the juror who I refer to as kind of the eye for an eye juror, you know, mm-hmm. the person who's like, look, a mother who kills their three kids does not walk out, period. Mm-hmm. That person goes to prison.
Yeah.
There could be the person that's kind of where you're at, where there's a misunderstanding of the burden, mm-hmm. treating reasonable doubt as any doubt, or in reverse, treating the Commonwealth's concession of mental illness, where,
yeah,
remember that part.
Like, which makes it even more confusing.
Right. At that yeah. point, everybody's like, okay, well, she definitely had a mental disease or defect. We're all in agreement to that.
Yeah.
At that point, what we're not in agreement about is whether or not that mental disease or defect caused Lindsay Clancy not to know right from wrong, or didn't allow her to conform her conduct to the requirements of the law, right? So,
yeah.
And that's a weird thing for people to try to understand.
It
you
is.
Know what I mean? It's like, okay, wait, you know, because basically their last two witnesses landed in the Commonwealth, I'm talking about, landed on the concept that they went with bipolar 2. Like, that is what mm-hmm. they said that she had.
Yeah.
And they both said, like, with bipolar 2, she still understood right from wrong, and she was able to conform her conduct, right? So mm-hmm. you've got that kind of floating through this juror's head, it potentially. And we don't know what this juror's thinking. We don't sure. know if it's the eye for an eye juror. And the other part of it is we don't know exactly what the note says.
Yeah.
What we had was Judge Sullivan kind of paraphrasing, because mm-hmm. it's Sullivan who says the jury's basically saying that the juror has acknowledged doubt, but they're refusing to apply the law. That was like the sentence that he said.
Yeah.
Doubt is slippery.
Like, yeah.
He didn't use the word reasonable doubt. He just mm-hmm. said the word doubt. So that leaves us out in the outside world kind of speculating, right?
So was it appropriate for Sullivan to paraphrase it that way? Because I keep doing all these different scenarios in my head, because I've learned so much from you, Bob, you know, on, especially on the defense side. You know, when I saw them deliberating long, I was like, wow, as Bob says, they're doing the hard work. This wasn't just a call it in thing. And this is actually watching the justice system at work in the right. state of Massachusetts, because many other states, this wouldn't be going on like this. And then the interpretation of what the law is, if that person believes they were acting lawfully, then they're acting lawfully. I mean, because it's kind of a subjective thing. But at the same time, there's a few things that had they not been done or said, would we be here? Like if they tried another state. And also, if Sullivan, Judge Sullivan, had not said that and merely said the jury came back again and said they couldn't all agree. I mean, in other words, what was the compulsion to share? Because that's what really flamed things up even more, is like throwing kerosene on the fire, that he said, well, we have one holdout. Then everyone's jumped into the conclusion, rightfully it looks like, including Reddington, that it's a holdout for the criminally insane. And it's like, and so it seemed to exasperate a situation. What do you think about that?
Yeah, first of all, it is rare. I don't know that I've ever seen a four-person of a jury send out a note like that.
Yeah.
Because essentially, like, if the four-person is not the elected official of the, you know, a country, it's not an autocracy. it's you know, they're a person that is kind of in charge of going through the instructions and trying to keep some, you know, some modicum of control in there, in terms of, all right, let's, like, everybody calm down. Let's try to ease it back a little bit. You know, they're trying to move the deliberations forward in a positive way if they can, you know, which is a tough gig back there.
Yeah.
You know, but for that juror that wrote the note, they didn't independently write it without talking with the other jurors, including the other juror, which was probably more like, look, I'm about to whistleblow on your ass. Like, 11 of us are in agreement. I'm sending this note out. I'm telling the judge what's happening in here, and that's it. And the other juror was probably like, go for it. I don't care. You know what I mean? I mean, we know the holdout was holding out because the other personality trait is that people harden under pressure. You know, if you're going to bristle up, it's 11 versus one and you're feeling cornered, I mean, you're going to protect yourself. I mean, it's human nature. I mean, we all do that, and you're going to get defensive, you know, which is a natural instinct. So
should he filter that? Should he have filtered that out then, Sullivan?
What I would like to have seen is just the actual note read verbatim. Hmm. Like that. That's typically what you hear is a note being read verbatim. And the difference between us and the lawyers is the lawyers heard the note verbatim.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever Reddington's saying, and he's really
based the only on the one note,
who
right?
spoke on the note, because you have to understand in this situation, this was an absolute Hail Mary touchdown catch for the Commonwealth because they were on the verge of losing this trial.
Right.
Like they were thrilled. They were thrilled with the mistrial. This is a weird opposite effect. Because in my estimation, it was a reverse jury nullification, wherein it was one particular juror that was refusing to, from my estimation, follow the law. Because I believe that the juror said, look, okay, you know, whatever, there's doubt. You know, maybe didn't even say, yeah, okay, I think there's a reason. We have no idea what was going on, what was being said over 7 days, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But at some point, there's some acknowledgement by that person that yeah, okay, there's some kind of doubt. I don't care. I don't care. You know, like, she killed her kids. She's going to prison. That's like, you're never getting me to change my vote. That's that. So yeah, we can talk about this for 100 years, and I'm never changing my mind. The problem with that is that person, before they were selected as a juror, was asked if they could put that aside. Mm-hmm. If you put your personal biases and your feelings and your convictions. And if your answer to that is no, that's totally fair.
And then you're not on the jury.
Allowable.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you have to be honest about it.
Yeah.
And you have to tell the judge, I'm sorry, judge. I feel so strongly about this that there is no circumstance under which I am going to ever change my opinion on that. I honestly don't care what the evidence. There is no shame in that.
And they could also have done it, though, but they also could have done it. I mean, few of us, if any of us, have seen and heard such horrendous things as they saw during that case. And so you could easily come in with thinking you have a very open mind until you witness the things they did, like the 9/11, you know, the 911 call, which was horrific. Again, just from what we heard. It would make you more, you know, convicted in there. And this isn't the first case that things like this has happened on either. So it just, again, it's imperfect solutions to an imperfect system, but it's still a system. So it's a tough situation.
Yeah. And that's what I've said. You know, like that juror could have been asked that question at the point, because every juror's asked that question.
Yeah.
Every juror that indicates that there might be some kind of bias, that they have an opinion on it coming in, is asked that question. Well, okay. It's how you rehabilitate jurors. You know, I always hate it as a defense attorney. I'm like, they're not changing their mind. It's like, right. I know, you know, and the judge is like, because then that we were talking about this last week, that's the point where I have to get rid of a juror for, you know, using one of my challenges, my peremptory challenges. I have to say, okay, well, they should have been booted for cause, because you and I both know that's bullshit. That person's never changing their mind because they're human. Yeah. You know, so that question's asked, but to your point, Robin, it's very likely that juror wasn't lying on the front end.
Yeah.
The juror probably said, well, yeah, I can apply the law despite what he feels. And then, like you said, as the evidence starts coming in, he realizes midway through, like, man, there's no way.
Right.
Like, I'm not going to be able to do this. It's like, I feel the way I feel. My convictions are what they are. My morality is what it is. And I'm not going to be able to change my mind on that. And then what's that juror supposed to do at that point? You know what I'm saying? Like the train has left the station.
Yeah.
You know, and the other part of this that's really, you know, problematic is that we get the Tui Rodriguez charge, all right, or the Dynamite charge or the Allen charge. They call it different things in different jurisdictions. But that essentially tells, and there's the language in that, tells the jurors in the minority to reexamine their views, but it also tells them not to surrender an honest conviction just to reach a verdict.
Right.
So that language exists in the Tui Rodriguez charge, which is the last charge that went back. So when that juror is hearing that, like that exact language, you know, not to surrender an honest conviction just to reach a verdict, Sullivan reads it, and then the jury
there's
comes
your
back.
There's your personal confirmation bias. You hear what you want to hear to double down on what you're already thinking.
Yeah.
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 It's like a dog and pony show that we present, and we think, oh, this will all work out well. These people will follow these rules and this Tui Rodriguez charge. This will get them. At the end of the day, there really are no consequences to a juror not following the instructions. It's pretty much it's the honor system.
But in their mind, they did. You know,
in their mind, you're exactly right. And somebody early on here in this, you know, there's a lot of ways you can think about it. You can think about it. Well, they went in and they knew that they were going to do this. Maybe not. Like you were saying, maybe they went in thinking, I will be very unbiased, right. And maybe the evidence hit them in such a way they're like, shit, no, bitch is going down, if that's what that's how they're thinking. Yep. And that's their conviction. That's truly what they believe. And that's not them necessarily going in thinking, I'm going to convict her no matter what. That's them seeing the evidence and further being fortified into their own position. Mm-hmm. At the end, I mean, and then everybody goes into the world of, well, what if this juror had, you know, what if they came into it knowing they're going to hang it? And they were, okay, there's that argument. And that certainly can happen. I'm not saying it happened here. I don't know if it happened here, but that can certainly happen. But Bob, does a consequence exist for someone who goes into a trial with the ill intent, not the my opinion changed or further fortified this way or that way, one that went in, lied to the attorneys, lied to the judge going in that they could be unbiased, knowing full damn well, I'm going to convict her. I don't care what the hell you present to me in the next handful of weeks. This is what I'm going to be. Is there any consequence for that if that could ever be proven? Like if it's like, yep, they said it going in. Here they are on video saying exactly that. I'm not saying they are.
Not that I'm aware of.
No, it's just like, okay.
Yeah, I mean,
shame on the attorneys for not catching that person that basically got through the cracks, basically.
Right. You know, because I mean, if you go all the way back to the OJ jury, you know, when it came out after the fact, long after the fact, you know, when we've seen some of the documentaries that were made and they got some of the jurors on there and like, this was an eye for an eye for us as black people, because the Rodney King verdict had come down for the cops who had beaten the shit out of him on the side of the road and they were all acquitted. Like this was us literally saying, okay, how you like it? We're doing, you know what I mean? And I don't remember hearing anything happening to those jurors. You know,
right.
I don't know what you do in that situation. I mean, if I were the holdout juror, you know, I mean, your solution to that is to simply say, my understanding of reasonable doubt is that the Commonwealth met its burden. You know, they proved it beyond a reasonable doubt to me that she didn't have psychosis. I mean, that's the easiest thing for that person to say. But then again, like, we don't know what the note says verbatim. That's where the whole thing here is. Yeah. You know, it's like, maybe it says exactly that. Maybe it just uses the word doubt, you know, and maybe the other 11 are misconstrued. It's a situation we're in. We can't get into the providence of the providence of the deliberations has to be sacred, you know, which is ultimately why Sullivan's like, and I disagreed with them. I think that there was probably a very generic answer or a question rather that he could have asked that wouldn't have gotten into the providence of the jury deliberations, because you can't have a judge inserting himself in there. You sure. can't have a judge asking specifics about what they're deliberating about. Like, okay, well, yeah. let me, what is your understanding of reasonable doubt? And like, let me tell you what it means. Like, that can't happen.
Right.
That can never happen with the jury. You know, they're given the instructions. They've been agreed upon by both sides. Both sides send them back and the judge sends them back and that's it. And there is no explaining the law. We say whatever the law that has been given to you that you are to apply is in your hands. You need to go back. Yeah. You need to read it again and you need to apply it as you see fit.
But is this one of the reasons why also, because, you know, I don't think I've ever followed a case this closely with so many what ifs going through my mind with deep analysis, not just on the loss of the three children and what caused it in Lindsay and whether I believe in the psychosis or not psychosis, but all these things. And to come back with a jury finding like this with one person holding out, is this one of the reasons why we have an appeals process? Because it is an imperfect system, or is that a wholly different thing?
It's a wholly different thing. I mean, this isn't really, I think there's going to be a filing in this case mm-hmm. by the appellate counsel, probably the same one who did the 211-3 petition to try to stay this. In order to try to force the judge into having that individual voir dire with that one particular juror, as you saw, the SJC turned around pretty quickly and said, no, we don't see it here. And I'm assuming if the note would have been any more particular as to what was said, then they might have come back a different way. So, because we read that petition on the air, like when that whole thing when it was happening was insane. Like it was happening so fast, it was completely out of left field. Even though Allie and I were screaming on our live that they need to file that thing, and then Red all of a sudden does it, and you know, and he had been talking to, like after I think it was probably right after Tui was sent back, and then I think at that point he probably reached out to the appellate lawyer and said, look, you know, you need to prepare this petition, because I have a feeling this thing's going to come back hung, like this juror's just not budging, and I want the judge to question this juror. And generically, though, again, it has to be generic,
right?
You know, it has to be like a question, like that same question that was asked in the beginning, not getting into the details of the deliberations, but just saying, you know, are you able to put aside your bias or your opinion and follow the law? Because the law is, if you find that the Commonwealth has not met their burden beyond a reasonable doubt, and they use that moral certainty language in Mass, which is it's lofty language.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It's way loftier language than we have in Illinois. You know, moral certainty is pretty intense. So, you know, and just ask that generically. And, you know, if the juror at that point, if they're one of those folks that in good faith said, yeah, I'll be able to put my bias or my opinion or my convictions aside and follow the law on the front end. But like you said, Robin, he hears the plaintiff wails of Patrick Clancy when he discovers his kids and he's like, holy shit.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be able to do this.
Right.
You know,
it's a human reaction.
That's
very reasonable.
It's a human reaction. And it's only going to bolster the way that person's feeling coming in. Anyway,
you know, very much so. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue our conversation about the Lindsay Clancy lack of verdict.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.